Welcome to this special EG Shedmasters podcast with me as your host, that's Sam McCleary. So industrial and logistics looks set to remain one of the top remaining commercial property sectors this year. But with increasing consumer demand, meaning more warehousing is needed, a labour shortage imminent, and the yet and still unknown effects of Brexit on the supply chain, how can we ensure that it does indeed remain that top performing commercial property sector? And how can we predict what and where we should be investing and developing? Over the next 20 to 30 minutes, we'll be talking to a gaggle of experts, I think that's the correct terminology, about that darned B word, the never-ending rise of online demand and the ever-shortening expectations of delivery times, the impact of the high street on the full supply chain, and the, of course, the role of tech in the logistics sector. So let's get on and meet that gaggle. So first, Nigel Rowe, who is a European Business Development Director at Mount Park. Nigel has more than 30 years' experience in the sector and joined Mount Park last year.
Indeed, yes.
And Mount Park, of course, is the firm run by that logistics legend, John Cutts, and is developing across 7 European countries. Next to Nigel, not that you can see it because this is a podcast, is John Clements, who's European Development Director of Verdion, investor, developer and asset manager set up in 2010 that has a portfolio that now is now valued at more than €800 million. Next to John is Kester Purslow, who's Senior Director at Architects RPS. And while we may never have thought of logistics as a sector that you'd need architects in, because most people think of boxes, don't they? But that's so wrong because, I'm getting looks here, because it is a sector where functionality is so, so important. And so I'll be looking forward to hearing a little bit more about that a little bit later. And last, but definitely not least, is Alex Verbeek, who is a UK Managing Director of Gaisley, one of the biggest investors and developers in the industry and part of the GLP family. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Now, before we get into those 20 minutes of discussion, I guess I should point out that I am the only female in the room today. And I know there's plenty of women in the industrial sector. And I just want to pose one question for us to think about, which I'll come back to at the end of our discussion, which is, why do we think that industrial logistics is rightly or wrongly thought of as a male-dominated sector? And then I'd like to know about your companies and what you're doing within them to help promote and support women in the sector. So we'll come back to that, plenty of time for you to think about it. But let's crack on, and we should start first with that darned B-word that I mentioned earlier, Brexit. So we don't know what's happening yet, we haven't known for some time, but 29th of March is fast approaching. And I think everyone's keen to know what everyone is thinking about what they're going to do on that day, if indeed it is D-Day or B-Day. So, Nigel, I'm going to start with you. How are Mount Park preparing for 29th March?
I think that we're listening to our customers. That's the easy one for us. Trying to predict any of the process since June 2016, I think we've seen that that's not an easy task and that nothing has happened the way we feel it could or should. And so In that fashion, we're looking at what our customers are doing, what they're saying, what they want to do, and how they're planning for that date. And of course, we have a pan-European view, so we have people worrying about that from both sides of the English Channel. And I think what the answer is, and what they're saying is, well, let's let that date come, see what happens. Don't try and predict it, but make sure that we have every opportunity covered.
Does that pan-European view help or hinder, or is there too many views, or does it help you think about all the different inputs you could have?
That's probably both an easy and a difficult question to answer. I think I'll go for the easy one, which is I can see a view that says that everyone's worried about Brexit. It's not just a British thing. All of our customers across the pan-European cycle are worried about the worst case scenario, which I think is a no-deal scenario. But everyone's planning about business going forward rather than worrying about the problems that might, well, not, not worrying, but actually just looking at the focus on what they can do rather than what may not happen.
Thank you, Nigel. John, for Verdion, how are you planning?
I think we're well prepared in our structure being a European business, that we've got different business lines in different Northern European countries. It's very hard to know the impact. One of the most obvious impacts at the moment is customers are just delaying decisions for longer term leasing, but there is suddenly a raft of interest in much more short term letting opportunities. So there's some opportunity there if that's what you're willing to consider for some of your better clients. It's very hard to know the long term impact, so we're just waiting and seeing like everybody else, and we'll react accordingly.
And Alex, would you echo that? Long-term is difficult to judge at the moment, but there's plenty of demand for short-term lettings?
Well, certainly I'd agree that the long-term sort of future view is a very difficult thing to predict. Normally, in times of change, one might argue that past performance is a good indicator of future performance, and that is quite possibly bolder statement to make at this point, but what has been interesting over the course of the last 2 years, as the stats will play out, that since that decision in 2018, we've had record take up in 2016, 17, 18 again, a very strong year. This year has started strong. I'm talking about our sort of customer interest in the space, whether it's through expansion or consolidation. It's started again as another very strong sort of first year or beginning of year, so I can't pretend to know the sort of full outcome, but I think being flexible, which may well involve some shorter lease structures or more flexible lease structures, and being adaptable, flexible and ready for change is the best that we can be in, and we feel like we're in that place as a pan-European business as well.
Fantastic. And Kester, for you, from your point of view, where you are working with these guys on creating the spaces, is it impacting your business?
Not at the moment. We've seen a very strong start to the year. That said, obviously there's a significant uncertainty at the moment. So what's going to happen moving forward is still to be understood and decided. As a business ourselves, though, we operate across a very diverse client base, so not only industry and logistics. We're also a global business, so although we're predominantly UK-focused, we do operate around the globe. So I think for us, a big part of the mitigation is looking at our different sectors, our different clients, and trying to mitigate any risk in that way. One of the things I think we've specifically identified from our office and in the UK is probably resources as a key risk. So how Brexit will affect people we already have in post, potential UK hires, and there are then also question marks over qualifications. So at the moment there's a UK qualifications are recognised in the EU and vice versa. So it's how that's going to come to the fore and how that's really going to have an impact on our business. But at the moment we're planning for that, and as I say, I think looking across a number of sectors and diverse clients, we'll try and mitigate any risk like that.
And talking about Labour, let's pick on some of the, not the political party, let's pick on some of those topics that capture the headlines, and whether they're really topics that should be allowed to capture the headlines. One being this potential labour shortage that's coming, and the other a lot of the nationals and maybe some more of the tabloid type nationals love building up stocks, don't they, and people finding sheds to just stockpile all sorts of things, from medicines to food to all sorts. Let's start with the labour question. Are you worried about a lack of labour? And then let's move on to stockpiling. Alex, start us off.
In terms of labour for our own business, no, not particularly. There has been a fair amount of press coverage about the potential shortage of labour for our customers, particularly warehouse operatives. There is generally a challenge, I think, with labour in the sector, and that is that there is not enough of it. And we're talking in the main particularly for those third-party logistics operators that are serving retailers or for retail customers. We're talking about a very cyclical business that peaks at the sort of seasonal events, Easter, Valentine's Day, Christmas, and so on. And when it peaks to about fourfold what would otherwise be its sort of day-to-day employment base. So that is an enormous amount of people that are sitting sort of available, perhaps transient, perhaps contracted, that are immediately available. It just in those peak periods. So there is generally a labour issue, I think in the context of Brexit. There is potentially, yes, a short, there will be, there has already been to some extent, and there will potentially be a greater shortage of that sort of immediately available labour for logistics in that space. But we have seen a change in the way warehouses are being operated, in particular through automation, which is changing the labour profile within the logistics sector more generally. And generally what that's doing is not diminishing the quantum of labour, but it's upskilling it. In the more upskilled professions within the sector, there is more domestic labour and less international labour. So I think those two things are kind of converging, and one would expect therefore to have less of an impact that one might immediately think.
And we'll talk a little bit more about the role of tech in this industry a little bit later. John, do you concur with that? Are you seeing the same sort of issues?
Yeah, without a doubt, our clients, one of the major concerns, perhaps the major concern, is the availability of skilled labour for the warehouse operations at the moment. We've been quite fortunate at our largest UK scheme at Nyport in Doncaster, where there is still a good pool of strong labour available. But it's becoming harder and harder for clients across the country, particularly the Midlands and South East, to get the staff they need. Brexit is not going to help that at all. Long term there may be new arrangements put in place to source staff, the right type of staff to staff the facilities. So it's a major concern. It's not a problem that's going to be solved quickly. And it'll be interesting to see how the government reacts as and when clients start to say we just can't get the staff. That's going to push up costs, and that'll trickle down.
And Nigel, same for you?
It's exactly the same. I think all of our collective customers, are not making any move geographically or business growth, even reduction if that's the case, without doing very careful employment studies. Occupiers looking to move from one location because of growth or whatever those factors into another are looking at staff retention, how far they can go as a result. But also who else is in the market, target markets they're looking at? Do they need to be there, avoid them, etc.? I think another interesting factor after a conversation I had with some Central European colleagues is exactly the same in the markets we think of being full and being open, have large numbers of employable labour, so Central Europe, etc. They've got their tight spots and they've got their concerns over labour and movement. So that it's very, very important for everybody throughout all the markets in Europe right now.
Excellent. And then in terms of the other headline around stockpiling, is that fake news, or are you seeing any of that happening?
I don't think I've seen anything specifically. That really doesn't mean it's not happening. but I think that's a wonderful story. I think it's good talk if you're planning and preparing. Is it actually happening? Have I been seeing anybody stockpiling in any, or looking and making those requests in our markets in the UK? No.
I think there was a reference in the press recently to Pets at Home stockpiling. I think they referred to something like £9 million worth of stockpiling. £9 million in terms of stock for what Pets at Home sell isn't a lot of stock, and therefore not a lot of space. So have we seen, I think I agree entirely, have we seen sort of emerging requirements for a large amount of space in the short term? No, I haven't really, no.
Excellent. And let's hope that we don't need to stockpile, and that we find our way out of this. But how long is a piece of string? That's the question, isn't it? You mentioned earlier, Alex, that there's been record take-up. And I'd just like to sort of investigate a little bit about what's driving driving that take up, and whether it's the ongoing boom in online retailing, or whether that demand is coming from elsewhere.
You have described it as it is. It is the ongoing increase in online retail demand as a proportion of overall demand. And again, if you look back over the course of the last decade or so, first of all, the overall quantum, whether it's online or traditional bricks and mortar retail, the overall quantum of take up and demand from the retail sector has increased. I don't have the stats, but the market physically has got larger. And then over the course of the last 10 years, we've seen a gradual increase in the percentage of that retail demand from the online space as opposed to sort of traditional high street sort of shopping centre retail. I think that is what is driving it. I don't think it is. It is. I think that's a sort of matter of fact, and it's something which, interestingly, over the course of the last 2 years since the going back to Brexit and that decision, over that period of time and potentially into the future, albeit that there is this uncertainty, we've not seen that uncertainty trickle into an impact on the growth of online retail. And so that's really what's driven that record take up, and we expect that to remain strong in 2019 for that reason.
So it's not that it hasn't trickled into that sector of the market yet, or you just don't believe that it will trickle into that sector of the market?
Brexit or
the sort of the slowdown, the fear?
In short, no, I don't. I foresee the quantum of take up in 2019, and actually, this, if you look at, and again, if you go back to the numbers, if you look at the sort of quantum of take up over the last 5 years relative to the 5 years before that, we are at a sort of a new normal in terms of the quantum of take up in our space, which has been driven by that shift in online retail. So, no, I don't see that being an issue. What I do see potentially is the dynamics of the market changing potentially in the next couple of years, and therefore an impact on availability, supply, rental growth. But I don't think the sort of underlying quantum of take up is likely to move substantially. Certainly not back to kind of pre 2013 levels.
Okay, and let's talk about some of those dynamics then, Nigel. What do you see that might change in your market? Is it our want and desire as individuals, as consumers, to want everything at the touch of the button, and does that have a impact on your market and how you're able to deliver? Excuse the pun.
Yes, I think we're going to see a lot of that. I don't think we can even comprehend the extent of the changes that are coming. And when we look back in, say, 5 and even 10 years' time, we'll I think be looking back and saying, "Gosh, that was a period when the market changed in every sense." The growth of the online markets, and having said that, let's not write off the bricks and mortar guys. They're just working out which ones will survive and how what they have to do to survive, and they'll survive well because that's still going to be needed. So therefore, our market's going to grow, I think, in every sense, and then to be able to deliver that and to deliver the or the deliveries that need to come in and those super fast timescales that are demanded by the end customers, you and me sitting at home, those processes are going to just change beyond comprehension within our buildings, and the rate of change that our customers will be creating new systems, new setups, is already evident in its first sense, and is going to just increase, I think, from here on.
Excellent. John?
Yes, I totally agree with what the guys are saying. Demand has been strongly driven by e-commerce, the shift. Some major operators, we all know, are taking huge chunks of the market. If you look at Amazon, and also actually some traditional retailers such as Lidl and Aldi are also taking massive amounts of space. So they would account for a lot of that new kind of take up. I think it will continue for some time to come, but all good things have to come to an end at some point. So I think we should be a little cautious that growth won't continue forever. There will be a saturation point, and I think my biggest fear would be an economic downturn, and I think that will really turn the taps off the development pipeline, and I think that's what we just have to be cautious of. At the moment, there's a reasonably good equilibrium in the amount of space coming out now and the amount of take-up. I think that's reasonably conservative, but I think if there was a big disparity between the amount of, for example, speculative space coming through and the amount of take-up, then we might get into a slightly more sort of overheated situation in the market.
Because I guess we have seen some of the online retailers, ASOS, for example, they struggled a little bit over the Christmas period. So nothing lasts forever, does it? And I guess I'd be really interested to hear from your perspective how you view the high street. Then, Nigel, you mentioned the bricks and mortar. That, you know, there are those on the market who are doing okay, but there are also a lot of people who have crumbled. I think there's some, you know, 70 million square foot of retail space that's come back to market, and that must have an impact on stocks and how much space they need to be able to feed those shops. Is that something that you see down the supply chain, or is it not hitting yet, or are you preparing for it?
I think it's very evident. I think that it's survival of the fittest. It's true evolutionary development and progress for these guys. The ones who are getting it right will do it very, very well, and the ones who can't will find it very, very difficult to perform. I mean, I think we'd all agree that the supply chain assessment and analysis and specifics are being looked at so carefully by all the different high value and efficient operators in the market, and I think that's where we'll see the market developing and the real specifics in the winners and the losers in the market going forward, and how they operate and what they do, and even down to the tech and robotic issues within the buildings that I know we're going to talk about soon.
I mean, what's amazing in that space is that you mentioned ASOS. They were one of the early and most successful pure play online retailers, and their sales figures have dropped. So given the sort of first mover advantage, you'd have thought that their market share perhaps would have been higher than it is. So, and I don't pretend to know a great deal about ASOS's business model, but it would suggest that even being in the space is not in itself the sort of key to success. As technology evolves, their investment in technology involves understanding that customer offer, getting their returns right, and so on and so on, and are all absolutely key to people growing and maintaining their market share in that space. And although I'm not a logistics expert, nor do I shop at ASOS. Nothing wrong with ASOS, I just don't.
Other online retailers are available.
Thank you. But as clearly there is enormous amount of evolution, which I think is, I think I pick up on Nigel's point. It's going to be difficult for us to understand what it looks like in 3 years, 5 years.
I'd go further to say that that's exactly right, that point. But it's also, they're all, even the guys who are doing it really well are working it out as they go along. Look how often they change their operation, change the system and the setup, and the ones that are doing that are the ones looking at it carefully and who will survive and who will take the whole business further forward.
And if those guys are able to chop and change and make it up as they go along, how much does that require you as a space provider to be able to change really quickly as well and sort of react? And Alex used that great word evolution, which I think real estate's really going through that at the moment. How are you evolving to those needs from occupiers?
Well, in terms of development, and in particular, I suppose, built to suit development, if you're responding to a particular requirement and therefore providing a building for someone that suits or is tailor-made to them, I guess it's true of spec as well. I think the ultimate point is to be flexible, to be able to respond to change quickly. And I mean that in terms of physical buildings being delivered, building specification, being open-minded and flexible and adaptable to the needs of those evolving customers. I mean, I'll give you a couple of examples. We have a building which is in Daventry, which we leased to Amazon. And when we started the negotiations, it was to be taken for a very specific purpose in the supply chain of Amazon. And by the time 6 weeks later, we exchanged and contracted with Amazon, it was repurposed for a completely different use. Now, that is a big business that can adapt to those sorts of changes, but it just shows how quickly things are evolving. Mm-hmm. And likewise, we delivered a number of built-to-suits last year, but one in particular comes to mind where we went through, I think, 125 change orders as we delivered the facility for amendments to building specification and design that weren't ill-conceived at the beginning. The needs of the customer just changed as we went through, and that was through a 25-week build period.
Hmm. Kester, how annoying is that as a designer?
Well, I completely agree. You know, I guess the question is, what is spec and how is that sort of evolving? Because a lot more of the buildings, I think, certainly the larger scale sheds are more built to suit, from our perspective, in terms of the design. Spec originally, or certainly historically, was more about wide and narrower racking, standard racking sizes. You know, I think for us, building in flexibility is absolutely key. Far more of the speculative buildings are now being retrofitted in terms of mezzanines, for example. So I think online is driving more multi-tier, high throughput mechanical handling systems, which we weren't seeing before. So the sort of profile of how spec sheds are then being redesigned to accommodate e-commerce is changing. So I think looking at the design very early on in terms of maximum flexibility, being able to potentially put in retrofitted mezzanines, straight away if those go in, we're looking then at potentially fire comparted staircases on the outside. If you look at a number of, for example, the Amazon buildings we've looked at as retrofits, again, big increase in terms of car parking, so quite often putting decked car parks in. So there is certainly a lot of retrospective redesign and ongoing design as well, because I think the technology is such at the moment that it's moving so quickly that, for example, we've designed for Kiva robots, and the robot technology is changing building upon building. And so the design of the mezzanines, the flatness that's required, it's all an ongoing change at the moment. So it is, you know, we are always playing catch up, really.
So there's a phrase that the office guys like to throw around a lot, talking around being flexible with this space as a service, and like to use it as if it's a new thing in real estate. But it sounds, from chatting to you guys, that's what industrial logistics has been since day one. It's creating space that serves your customers. Would you agree with that, John? Is that...
Absolutely, and we put a huge amount of time and effort into delivering what our clients need, and I think it's always better, in my personal opinion, to for a client to have a built-to-suit building if they have enough time, you know, to plan and execute that, because they'll get exactly what they want. Having to retrofit a speculative unit is always a little bit more tricky, can be a bit more expensive, and it's not always the best solution. But yeah, we try and go that extra mile. We're willing to do a lot of fit out for clients, as you know, look at different funding solutions for that, do the actual work itself as well. I know that's going a little bit outside of the remit of a typical developer of warehouses, particularly in the UK. So we're trying to add a bit more value and offer that services to clients, so you know they get exactly what they want. We don't just leave them with an empty box and say, there you go, you finish it off. But we'll do that for them if that's what they want.
Nigel, is that something that you do at Mountain Park as well?
It is. I think you have to be flexible in the sense that these are long-term investments, investment properties that we're putting a long-term future into. But equally, you need to have the specificity. Is that a real word?
It's difficult to say at this time of morning.
To have the specifics that are needed to run the operation in. So I think a combination of being able to have that paradise of both worlds is really important, and understanding the specific needs that drive them and where those needs might go, without trying to necessarily predict them, because the end customer, those of us in our behind our computer screens at home, is the end customer, and we're demanding people, and that's got to run right through the supply chain into the buildings that we operate and the rest of the many influences within the market.
And now we have briefly touched on the T word, the sexy word in real estate at the moment, tech, and about some various impacts that has on your businesses, robotics being one of them, online retailers being another. I would just love to hear from each of you how you are utilising tech yourselves within your business, and then also the impact and hopefully benefit that you see it having on the market as a whole going forward. I am going to start with you, Alex.
So how have we utilised tech in our own business? I guess in two or three ways. I mean, it goes without saying, our ability to be able to work remotely, conference calls, video conferencing, and so on is absolutely standard as the market norm. I think the day is gone that you phone somebody on a mobile and say you can't get into the VC, you're constantly having to phone somebody up and say your PowerPoint presentation doesn't work. That's not, it, to my mind at least, is not sort of acceptable anymore, and it's certainly not how we operate. I would add that in terms of our own storage of information and how we manage our customer relationships, that is done in a much more sophisticated way now with tech services, which I think makes us more efficient and therefore enhances the offer to our customers in terms of responsiveness and connectivity, particularly for a global business. And lastly, in terms of building design, I think point was made earlier on about buildings to a sort of standard developer shell. That is a wind and watertight enclosure within which to operate, but it isn't an operational building. And in some cases, to make those buildings operational, they spend at least as much money again. Our customers will spend at least as much money again to get them functioning. That's so land and building is 50% of the overall cost of these buildings running. And to facilitate that, we do all of our building design now in BIM, building information modeling, so it's all done in 3D. It provides a better interface between our customer systems and our own, and enhances efficiency for things like clash detection and so on. So it reduces waste, has a number of other advantages. So yeah, we are doing our best to harness as much of that as is available. Yeah,
fantastic. Kester.
Following on from Alex's point, really, in terms of how we design buildings, everything is done in Revit in our office, which is a 3D package. And again, utilising BIM, so we're a BRE accredited BIM office. So everything we do is in 3D, which, as Alex said, helps reduce clashes, makes coordination with other consultants far easier. And another thing we're doing now is we have a bespoke VR team. So within our office, we have three guys who are specifically dedicated to virtual reality. So what we can do is, because our buildings are designed in 3D, we drop them into VR, and then we can take those to the client, or they can come to us. They can walk through the building with the goggles. They can actually physically see how the building is being designed. They can make changes in a real-time environment, and they can choose everything from how the toilet finishes look to how the office space works, and all of that can then be fed back into the design of the building. So VR is becoming quite prominent, everything from using that for end users, planning consultations. So we're often now setting up a VR room where people can actually, the public can come in and see how the building will impact on them. So we're doing all of those sort of things. And then in terms of the design of the buildings as well, we are now using things like point cloud surveys, which we wouldn't have used before. Drones are being used for survey so that we can get real-time information from the site. So I think in terms of the way buildings are designed, technology is really pushing us quite hard, and for the good, really. So it is making the design process far more efficient in terms of how we can produce drawings.
Fantastic. And John at Podium?
Well, yeah, throughout the design procurement process, there's all kinds of technology. For example, our general contractors, our earthworks contractors, are using GPS satellite technology on their dozers. So everything is programmed in, and they hardly need to even operate the machines these days. The shovel goes up and down and levels the ground. So this technology is used there. On the design process, Kes just mentioned, our architects are using all kinds of new technology. We're looking at using VR. So our clients can view our buildings, the next generation of speculative units. And of course, our clients, and I think our clients, the occupiers themselves, are the leaders in tech. Companies like Amazon, they are really at the very forefront in globally in technology. So we are learning a lot from them, and we are learning to implement their technology in the buildings we develop for them.
Excellent, thanks, Nigel. Have got lots of robots in your buildings?
Well, I was going to say it's the fit out of the buildings. It's what's going into the buildings and the information about how they run and operate, and that's what drives all the customers that I'm talking to. They want to know how much they're spending in their buildings so they can reduce those costs. They want to know what the heating costs or the lighting costs. All those information systems are all going into the buildings that we're all putting together. and that they're driving that, and they're able to see how they're able to save money, save costs on that side of it. So tech is really important there. Then there's actually operating within the buildings. So there's all of the robotics going into the systems. We know the companies using robotics to move it, but I say we know them. They're all starting to do it. They're either sophisticated operators of it now, or they're moving into it in a big way. So then they have a big capex requirement to go into the buildings and the systems, and McKesson talked about mezzanines and different racking systems, etc. And of course, all this adds up to huge increased power requirements. You talk to any occupier, be they a manufacturer or a simple logistics operator, they now need phenomenal levels of power to be tied up and reserved within these buildings. And that's probably one of the single most important factors that is the end result of the robotics and the tech element of the buildings that we're now putting together.
And does that provide a challenge for you, or an opportunity for you as investors, developers?
Well, I'm afraid it's the easy answer is both, of course. it is a real challenge. All of our collective customers need support in that area, both in terms of taking the buildings on in the first place, but then running them and then often needing more power as they go along. And then the opportunity is to be well organised and well set up. And those of us that I think are getting it right are getting those ducks lined up and making sure that all those options are covered and understanding with real knowledge what that part of the market's all about, in a way beyond traditional sheds.
Could battery storage become a new part of the industrial world?
It's huge. It's already here. In fact, a lot of customers are demanding it up front and finding ways of harnessing power, storing it and using it at a later date, both because it's cheaper and because you get more of it.
And we talked at the beginning of this podcast a bit around the diversity word. And I wonder, before we get to that final question, or first question that I posed, do you think that all of this... So the evolution of the market, in that we are doing so much more with tech, we are responding so much better to customers. Do you think that helps us as an industry to attract a greater spectrum of people to the sector? Maybe makes the industry sound sexy and exciting to that next generation?
I think it might. That in itself might. But I think it's been underrepresented to some extent, because it just had a lower profile, full stop. So the vast majority of our, 70% of all of our customers generally in the big box sector are retailers, directly or indirectly. And over the course of the last 20 years or so, we've seen more and more outsourcing. So you see the actual end user, the high street name, taking space. Which has enhanced the profile together with online retail. 20 years ago, there was much more third-party logistics operator control. Mm. And so there are a whole pile of occupiers of these buildings that their term, you know, given their profile, were just sort of less known about. So it hit the headlines less. The buildings were steel portal frames, perhaps slightly less sophisticated and sexy, as you say, than shopping centres, for example. And so it was just, I think people were just frankly less aware. And now people are considerably more aware, considering 60% of most households buy, 60% of all retail purchases are online. People want to know if it hasn't turned up, why it hasn't turned up, and therefore have some insight for the first time, you know, this decade really, over where it came from and how it got there. People didn't really have to worry about that before.
So just more visible now?
I think so. I mean, simple answer, but I think that's going to have added to...
But also, Alex, I think you're right in that we've moved away from it being the industrial property market. When I started, sadly far too many years ago, it was grotty industrial.
30, we said that already.
Yeah. I was trying to hint that it wasn't quite as long. But
30, everyone.
Yes.
For the record.
One more time. Okay. But it was
30.
Yes. But grotty industrial. I mean, I started, you know, having to, you know, we even got a suit allowance for washing because we were going through grotty industrial sites. And frankly, that wasn't the glamour part of the market. And it was the small, cheaper part relation of the market. Whereas, come on, that's wholesale change now, hasn't it? Mm. And it's as you say, I think it was great point. It's in our front room at home. It's everyone knows about it because we have to rely on that logistics and supply chain market.
Fantastic. So let's go back to the female question. I am the only one in the room, as far as I know. And just hopefully you guys all know that we here at EG are trying our hardest to help the industry and help be more diverse, and we like to have a diverse set of voices talking about things. So I'd like to know from you guys how next time we have this conversation we can maybe balance it out a little bit, and sort of how you and your companies are striving to do that yourselves. Nigel, I'll start with you.
I think it's a very important question. I think my previous comment that it used to be a grotty, dirtier end of the market was a key factor to that. And I think that the industry is now a lot more sophisticated, a lot more inviting to all sectors, and that underrepresentation of women in our business has been a big thing that I think a lot of companies are working very hard to address. There are lots of groups now. There is a lot of programs in almost all of the competitor group that I see, and in particular where the source of a lot of the people who come in and work for our companies are the agents. They're working very, very hard at that. I think I would say very successfully too.
Fantastic, John.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Nigel's saying. I think it's been a historic reason for the lack of female representation in the business. Throughout the whole surveying culture itself, the whole business, there's always been an underrepresentation. But I think that is changing, and I think it has been changing probably the last 10, 15 years. And the logistics warehousing sector is probably the last bastion which probably needs to perhaps do a little bit more to encourage people. I think the success, though, of the industry of the last 5 years will naturally encourage more people generally to want to be in the sector, and hopefully more females. I don't think there's been any necessarily positive discrimination. I've never seen any of that, and I hope it'll change. I think it will over time.
I think certainly for us it's more of a generational change. I think historically engineering probably more so than architecture, but both disciplines have always historically been very male dominated. Certainly far more graduates coming through now are female as well, which is great. I think we do have a far more diverse mix in our office than we probably did 5 or even 10 years ago, which is all for the good. So far more graduate programs now are targeted at, certainly through the RIBA, the ICE, iStructe, all the different institutions now are doing far more to push for female attendance on the courses, which are then coming through. And I think certainly when we look at probably our profile in another 5 and 10 years, it'll certainly change even more. So more for the good, really.
Excellent. Alex?
We have, at Gaisley, our UK team is, of our market officers, of which there are 5, 2 of them are women, so 40% are women. We sponsor Women Industrial Property are doing, and will continue to seek to represent to enhance diversity in the sector. I think it's fundamentally important and something which I don't think has been overlooked. I think there are some structural issues there. Overt, let's say, but it's time for long overdue, really, time for that to change. Yeah,
fantastic.
And I'll add one more point. It doesn't need to be the last thing we talk about in an interview like this.
Doesn't.
It can be the first point.
Absolutely. It shouldn't need to. We shouldn't need to talk about it, and that's what I hope for in the future. Before we really go, because you always add one more in, don't you? And while that's a really positive place to finish, I'd love to get just a really quick final thought from each of you on your hopes and dreams for industrial logistics in 2019. Alex.
My hopes and dreams.
Hopes and dreams.
That there is balance in the landlord and tenant relationship. I think there has in the past been a tendency for commentators to refer to it being a landlord's market or a tenant's market, and there are some tentative advantages and disadvantages to which side of the table you sit on at what point in the cycle. We need to remind ourselves that although buildings and their design are often referred to as being institutionally acceptable, they are ultimately and need ultimately to be acceptable to our customers, without whom there is no value. So to remember why we're here, the customers that we service, and to maintain a healthy balance between the two parties, an owner and an occupier. or a landlord and a tenant.
Excellent. Nigel?
Yes, I think the rate of change in the market in the next 5 to 10 years, I think, as I said earlier on, is going to be considerable. And I think my hope is that that's going to work and to run, and the system that we operate in the property market generically is going to help make that work. And without it, it's going to become very difficult. And my hope would be that works positively rather than negatively.
Fantastic. Kester?
Hopes and dreams, certainly. A continued strong start to the year through 2019. In terms of design, it's a very exciting time for us. Online is really driving how buildings are designed. And everything's a challenge at the moment, so it's a really exciting time. So the evolution of building design to keep up with online. So may it continue, really.
Fantastic. And John?
Well, my hopes and dreams are quite simple. Let's hope for a very smooth and swift resolution to the Brexit question, and the markets can continue growing, and hopefully some strong economic growth coming through across Europe, and then hopefully we can all have a successful few years in the logistics business.
Excellent. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today in the EG podcast studio. Apologies for the heat, but it's cold outside. It's warm in here.